Can single cell profiling tell us anything about why women experience polycystic ovary syndrome?
What's the long-term risk after someone's had a TIA?
A new technique for guiding biopsies for prostate cancer diagnosis.
And improving the results of people that have carotid surgery to prevent stroke.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we turn to JAMA and this issue of the long-term risk of stroke after TIAs or minor strokes?
There are literally millions of people that have a transient ischemic attack or a minor stroke. A transient ischemic attack, or some people call it a pre-stroke, but these are people that have neurologic symptoms that resolve within 24 hours. Once they're over their minor stroke or TIA, what's their risk of having a subsequent stroke over the next 5 or 10 years? These investigators looked at all the available studies that looked at overall outcomes, and they picked 38. Some of these were prospective studies, some were retrospective studies, and these 38 studies included over 171,000 patients, average age of 69, and about 57% were males, 43% were females. And here's what they discovered. If you look over the 5 and 10 year cumulative incidence of stroke, it's 12.5% and 19.8%. About 1 in 5 individuals will subsequently have a stroke over the next 10 years. About half of those occur in the first year. And of those half, about 61% occur in the first 90 days. The time period for the greatest incidence is in the first year and in the first 90 days. So even though if someone has recovered from a stroke or TIA, they're still at high risk of subsequent stroke, and we need to improve that long-term outcome.
Let's talk about that, because aren't the majority of people who present to the medical system, and that's a caveat that I think is important, aren't they put on any coagulation, those who have an ischemic stroke, for sure? And then even the TIAs, my exposure to this is that even those folks are typically put on something for that purpose.
They're put on antiplatelet agents. And some would consider those, a type of blood thinner, but not quite as intensive, less bleeding side effects. And the antiplatelet agents have been clearly shown to be beneficial. Oftentimes, people continue those antiplatelet agents for just 90 days, because that's when the highest risk is. And sometimes they won't continue them afterwards. But what this study tells us is, well, although the risk is highest in the first 90 days, there's still a risk over the next 10 years. And so those agents need to be continued for a longer period of time. Other things we need to do in terms of risk factors, we need to lower blood pressure, tightly control sugar in people that have diabetes, control cholesterol as well.
I guess I'd like to remind folks that even a TIA is something that probably is going to require some kind of intervention with the medical system. And we know that people can be reluctant when they experience even the symptoms of a stroke to show up in an ED or to their primary care doc.
Elizabeth, that's really important, because someone has a neurologic deficit and it goes away and they think they're okay. That's far from the truth. 1 in 5 of those individuals will go on to have a major stroke. So people that have transient neurologic symptoms should certainly be evaluated.
That is absolutely the take home. Let's remain in JAMA and turn to this issue of, gosh, do we have a new technique for helping to guide biopsies for men who have suspected prostate cancer? We have reported so many times about this issue of MRI in helping to guide biopsy, and that's registered against ultrasonography. And we have reported, I think, at least 3 or 4 times on the efficacy of that approach in helping to target biopsies so they get to suspicious areas of the prostate and improve the chances that we're going to be able to diagnose disease that then needs to be followed up. Of course, MRI is not available everywhere, and it's expensive and it's invasive. So this is a study that takes a look at something called high-resolution micro ultrasonography guided biopsy as an alternative to this MRI fusion guided biopsy when men are suspected of having prostate cancer. This study took a look at biopsy-naive men from 20 centers in 8 countries with a clinical suspicion of prostate cancer based on their PSA or an abnormal digital rectal exam. They had 3 groups here. They had one that got micro-ultrasonography-guided biopsy, one that got micro-ultrasonography along with MRI fusion-guided biopsy, and another one where they employed the conventional ultrasonography fusion-guided biopsy with MRI. The primary outcome was their difference in detection of Gleason grade group 2 or higher cancers. They had a total of 678 men who underwent these biopsies. They found what they were looking for, this Gleason grade, in 38% of the micro-ultrasonography group alone, 34+% in the MRI conventional ultrasonography, and 40% plus in the group that used the micro-ultrasonography plus the MRI. So these were not statistically significant differences between these groups. Clearly shows that this micro-ultrasonography techniques got some legs.
It does. Here's what we know. If you just do blind biopsies, you may miss the cancer, especially the cancer that's advanced that deserves to be treated instead of just watched. MRI has been shown to be helpful in terms of guiding the biopsy, but only a third of people that actually have biopsies actually get an MRI beforehand to guide it. And by the way, it takes two procedures because you have to do the MRI and then you do the biopsy at a different time. So using this microsonography allows it to be done at the same time, doesn't require MRI equipment, so it can be used in places where there aren't MRIs. These individuals in this study had used it 50 to 100 times. They were considered to be experts at it. And in that setting, it's just as good as MRI.
I will note that the authors report that only 36% of urban and 28% of rural residents in the US currently receive an MRI prior to biopsy. And I think part of that is just because of the availability of MRI. This device, of course, they say, provides a 300% improvement in resolution compared with conventional ultrasonography. As you've said, this allows real-time visualization of prostate cancer. So this registration error where they're looking at the ultrasonography, registering it with the MRI is eliminated in this case. So it sure seems to me like this has got some really serious upsides. They need to buy this device in order to be able to employ it. And as you've already pointed out, people need to be trained in how to use it.
Yeah, the routine ultrasonography wasn't sensitive enough, but something that is 300% better at visualizing cancer, this is the value of this particular device in terms of directing the biopsy to be most successful in finding where the advanced cancer is.
So I guess we're going to agree that we're predicting we're going to hear more about this.
I certainly hope so.
Let's turn now to the BMJ.
This is a study that looks at trying to prove the results of what's called carotid endarterectomy. It's used worldwide that people have severe blockage of their carotid artery that predisposes them to stroke. So these are people that have blockages of 75% or greater in their carotid artery. To prevent a stroke, oftentimes these people are subjected to surgery. Unfortunately, that surgery is associated with complications in some individuals. As many as 5 or 10% may have either a symptomatic stroke or a silent stroke. That is, they don't have symptoms, but you can see it on the MRI. So what we'd like to be able to do is to make that surgery as safe as possible. This study looked at sonolysis. It's using a sono machine, like a Doppler, positioned over the artery during the time of surgery. Those sono sound waves can break up any small clots or prevent them. At 16 different European centers, there were over 1,000 patients that were having carotid endarterectomy over a 5-year period. And they looked at the incidence of ischemic stroke, transient ischemic attack, or even death within 30 days in people that had carotid endarterectomy, either just routinely or using the sonolysis in addition to surgery. And what they found is that addition of sonolysis decreased the incidence of those major complications from 7.6% to 2.2%. When they did the MRI looking for silent strokes, it decreased it from 17.4% to 8.5%. There was no adverse effects.
Another really stellar result that suggests that this ought to be a new standard of care. And we know, of course, that carotid endarterectomy has resulted in lots of little bits of what gets blown out of the inside of the artery getting loose in the circulation. So if this is something that helps to prevent that, I'm wondering if it would obviate the need for those little nets they use.
The nets are frequently used in people that have stents, less so during carotid endarterectomy. It's safe, it's routinely available, and it doesn't require a lot of expertise to use it.
Finally, then, let's turn to Nature Medicine. Single cell profiling in the human endometrium, so that inside lining of the uterus, in women who have polycystic ovary syndrome. Polycystic ovary syndrome affects 11 to 13% of reproductive aged women and causes an economic burden in the US of $8 billion in 2020. Did you know that?
No.
What happens to these women? Their key reproductive features include hyperandrogenism and ovulation and menstrual regularities, and those are exacerbated by obesity. They also have a lot of trouble getting pregnant. They have implantation failure, early and mid-pregnancy miscarriages, and higher risks for gestational diabetes, hypertension, preeclampsia. The endometrium in these women exhibits unopposed estrogen stimulation and progesterone resistance. And so what they did was take a look at, they harvested cells from the endometrium during the proliferative phase of the cycle in women with PCOS, that's how I will refer to it going forward, who also were characterized by overweight and obesity. They analyzed just shy of 250,000 endometrial nuclei, so the nuclei from these cells, from 27 biopsies. Those were five controls and 12 PCOS cases. And what they were able to identify were cell type specific disease signatures. They also took a look at samples that were taken after 16 weeks of metformin treatment in one group and lifestyle management in another group. And they showed that there were extensive recoveries from these disease specific endometrial signatures. So suggest that metformin could be used in these women to help ameliorate some of these cellular signatures that we see that indicate PCOS. OS.
Why this is particularly important is not only for the symptoms that you mentioned, but the women that have PCOS have an increased risk of endometrial cancer due to the altered sex steroid profiles that you mentioned, particularly hyperandrogenism and unopposed estrogen exposure. What this analysis does, it looks at specific genes that are activated with the thought that if we can target those more specifically rather than just using a gunshot approach, is that we may be able to decrease the risk of endometrial cancer and perhaps some of the other side effects associated with PCOS.
One reason this paper appealed to me was because of the novelty of taking a look at single cell characteristics.
Not only that, Elizabeth, but the fact that they could provide some intervention, in this particular case, either 16 weeks of metformin or lifestyle changes to show they could reverse many of these dysregulated genes.
And I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I think we're going to see more of this kind of analysis too.
We will, and I think this will open up new therapeutic targets.
On that good news note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up, make healthy choices.